It does seem to me that our culture is increasingly becoming a culture of worry and anxiety. I mean, can you remember the time when pretty well everything on telly was stuff to make you laugh and forget about your worries? Nowadays, all you get on the telly is stuff to worry about. Constant morbid material about what could go wrong, bad things that have happened to people and that could happen to you, diseases, warnings, hidden dangers, holidays from hell, one health scare after another. I was reading one paper recently which said that sunbathing decreases your chances of getting a particular cancer by 75%. Unfortunately, the same paper also said that sunbathing increases your chances of getting skin cancer by approximately the same percentage. So what do I do? And the same paper, not the same day, I mean you can go over the top, but to the same paper worked out what was the most dangerous time of the day for dying of particular things. Apparently 4 o'clock in the morning is a bad time. And for some strange reason, 3:10 in the afternoon is a very dangerous time. So ever since then, at 3:15 every afternoon, I go, rah! And then there's these health and safety things, potential hazards. I mean, the deacons have had to do a survey of the church listing potential hazards. When they got to the baptistry, I've actually seen it written down in print, the potential hazard, drowning. Which is absolutely right. I mean, if you are going to drown in this building, the most likely place to drown is the baptistry. I've never actually heard of anybody drowning in a baptistry. I have heard of people being electrocuted in a baptistry. Those electric heaters can be lethal. So that's another thing to worry about. But do get baptized. And then there's all these stories about school trips being banned. All school trips banned, just in case anything happens. A school just outside Carlisle, the headmaster has abolished Conkers, in case anybody gets hurt. For those of you from Holland, Conkers is an English hobby at autumn time, which is absolutely harmless, but which has been banned in some schools for health and safety reasons. And then there's your carbon footprint to worry about. I was reading recently that some expert has actually decided that walking is more harmful to the environment than driving in a car. I can't remember the argument, but it was probably something like all these factories producing shoes for you to wear out when you're walking actually produces more harm to the environment than the exhaust fumes from your car. So what do? Do you stop at home? Absolutely not. Did you know that 3/4 of all lethal accidents take place in the home? Stay away from home. Shall I just stay in bed? Disastrous. Did you know that 90% of the people who die in bed? So don't go to bed, especially at 4 o'clock in the morning. So if you see me wandering around Kendal at 4 o'clock in the morning, well, it won't be around Kendal because I'm going to stay away. Most lethal accidents take place within 1/4 mile of the home. So I'm going to stay away from home. I'm not going to bed, especially at 4 o'clock in the morning. And at 3:10 afternoon, every afternoon, I'll breathe a sigh of relief. It paralyzes you, doesn't it? And it is actually creating a real health problem in our society. Stress-related illness is very, very common. Doctors are doling out tranquilizers. And it's strange, isn't it? We live longer than any society in history, and yet we're more worried about our health. We have longer and more exotic holidays and shorter working hours and greater variety of leisure activities and more labor-saving devices than any other society in history, and yet we've managed to become the most stressed-out society in history. Why is this? Well, we know, of course, how precarious life is, and we don't actually believe in the life to come. We don't believe in the life to come. If we do believe in it, we're not very interested in it. We'd much rather be on earth than in heaven. So we don't have much to look forward to, and therefore death is the ultimate disaster to be avoided at all costs. And of course we don't believe in a sovereign God whose purposes and whose providence can be trusted. And the result of this, the result of our lack of belief in a sovereign God and our lack of real belief in the world to come, the result of that is this panic that we see all around us. Well, the Bible actually forbids us to worry. It actually says that worry, therefore, is sinful. If God forbids it, it's wrong. And if it's wrong, it's sinful. We tend to forget that. We tend to forget that God has authority over the whole of our lives, including our emotions. We tend to think that our emotions are somehow our own. They're untouchable. We can't do anything about them, and nobody else can do anything about them. And therefore we happily indulge in emotions which God forbids. And other Christians will often support us in those emotions and encourage us in those emotions rather than pointing out their sinfulness. But the Bible, Jesus in the passage in Matthew 6, Paul in the passage in Philippians 4, Peter in 1 Peter chapter 5, cast all your care, anxiety upon him because he cares or is anxious about you. Jesus, Paul, Peter, all forbid anxiety. So surely this must be one area where Christians are different from non-Christians. And the trouble is, a lot of the time we aren't. And the trouble is also that if you are a worrier, like me, and I tend to be a bit of a worrier, if you hear a preacher saying worrying is sin, well, it makes you even more worried, doesn't it? Doesn't help very much. It's just another thing to worry about. So we need to think about this. We need to think first of all about this word worry or anxiety. In the Authorized Version, in Matthew chapter 6, it's translated be careful for nothing, which isn't particularly helpful. Be careful for nothing. Don't be careful about anything. And the King James Version also translates, that's in Philippians 4, King James Version. And in the King James Version in Matthew chapter 6 says, take no thought about the morrow. Take no thought. Be thoughtless about tomorrow. They're not particularly helpful translations. The word careful has changed its meaning over the years. It used to mean literally full of care. That's what the word careful used to mean. Full of care. And nowadays, of course, it doesn't mean that. To be careful nowadays is the opposite of being careless. So we need to think about this word translated anxiety or care or worry in these passages. It's the same Greek word. And the word literally means to have a divided mind. You know the feeling, don't you? You can't think properly about what you should be thinking about because you're thinking about this other thing. It's preying on your mind. You can't concentrate. You can't settle down and tackle today's problems because you're thinking about what might happen tomorrow. You can't enjoy today and face today's responsibilities and sleep tonight because of your concern for tomorrow or next week or next year. You're distracted, in other words. That would be a good translation. Distracted. Bishop Ryle talks about wearing, corroding, self-tormenting anxiety. And John Wesley talks about the care which drinks up our spirits, which anticipates all the misery it fears, which poisons the blessings of today by fear of what may be tomorrow, and which cannot enjoy the present through apprehensions of future want. So that's what the Bible is talking about when it talks about worry, care, anxiety. It's not talking about wise forethought, careful, necessary preparations for the future. It's not talking about anticipating possible problems, minimizing risks. Joseph in the Old Testament was regarded as a wise man because he planned ahead. He knew there was going to be 7 years of famine. There was going to be 7 years of plenty before that 7 years of famine, and therefore he stored up during the 7 years of plenty for the 7 years of famine. And he was generally accepted as being a wise man. So saving for the future, or taking out insurance, is not wrong. And the ant is commended in Proverbs chapter 6. The ant is commended for doing just that. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 6. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food in harvest. In fact, one of the solutions to anxiety is to do all you can now. Don't just sit and worry and do nothing. Take any action you can now. Do all you can now as if it depended on you, and trust God as if it depended on Him. Okay. So let's look at this Matthew 6 passage first of all. We're going to concentrate largely on this Matthew 6 passage and then just finish by looking at the Philippians 4 passage briefly. And we've got here some arguments against anxiety. I should have pointed out also that when you think about anxiety or care or worry, we're not thinking about natural human concern. God doesn't make us superhuman. He doesn't make us unnatural people. We do need to remember that. If your son has just passed his driving test at the age of 17, and he goes out the night of the day that he's passed his test, and he says, "I'll be back at 10 o'clock, Mum or Dad," and he hasn't come back at 2 o'clock in the morning, you would be sinfully lacking in parental care if you weren't concerned. So anxiety is not the same as basic human care about people who are close to you. We need to perhaps point that out as well. All right, some arguments against anxiety in this passage from Jesus. And the first argument is simply God. God. Notice the emphasis in this passage on your Father. Your Father. Look at verse 32. The pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. 9 times in this chapter, the 6th chapter of Matthew, Jesus refers to your Father. 9 times. Jesus encouraged his disciples to think of God as their Father in heaven. And he sees everything. Verse 4. Your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. He is your Father who sees everything. He is your Father who knows everything. Verse 8. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. So he's your Father. He's in heaven. He sees all things and he knows all things. Now, do we really believe that? If we really believe that we have a Father God who sees all and knows all, then that is bound surely to make us less apprehensive and less anxious. So that's the first argument. Jesus' first argument is simply God. You believe in God, don't you? And God is your Father, isn't he? And he's sovereign, isn't he? And he sees everything, doesn't he? And he knows all things, doesn't he? Just God is the first argument. The second argument is the argument from the greater to the lesser. This is just a logical argument. This is just the use of logic. This argument goes something like this. If God cares enough to do the greater things, then we can surely trust him for the lesser thing. Verse 25. I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food, and the body more important than clothes? In other words, if God provides us with our lives, if he gives us our bodies, will he not also provide us with things of lesser importance? The food to maintain our lives, the clothes to cover our bodies. If God is interested enough in us to create us, and to form us, and to form our bodies so intricately, and to save us, we could add, through his Son Jesus Christ. If he is interested in us, enough in us to do those great things for us. If he is interested enough in us to care for those lesser things. I've just moved on to the next argument there. Then surely we can trust him for the greater thing. If he provides the big things, surely we can trust him for the lesser things. And Paul uses this argument in Romans chapter 8 as well. Paul often uses this argument. Romans chapter 8. He that did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how shall he not also along with him freely give us all things? If God was willing to give his own son to his enemies, to sinners, what will he not do for those who are his friends, for those who are his sons and daughters? If God cared enough to deal with the major problem of our sin, can't we trust him to deal with the relatively minor problem? If he did all that for us when we were his enemies, what will he not do for his sons and his daughters? The same argument in Romans chapter 5. If when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son, how much more now that we are reconciled shall we be saved through his life? If he was willing to do that for his enemies, what's he going to do? What's he not going to do for his sons and daughters? That's the argument from the greater, from the lesser to the greater. Or it might be the greater to the lesser. I'm getting confused. I never was any good at logic. You can tell I'm confused, can't you? You're all sitting there thinking, what on earth is he talking about? The nation of Israel should have learned this lesson. They should have followed this logic. God got them out of Egypt. He got them through the Red Sea. That was their really big problem. That was the greater thing. God looked after that. Then they came to trivial problems like food supply, water supply, Amalekites, walled cities in Canaan, and giants in the land. They weren't giants, really. They might have been a bit taller than the Israelites. But you know how we exaggerate, don't you, when we're scared? Giants in the land! And what were they They were trivial compared to what God had done to Pharaoh and to Egypt and to the Red Sea. They were the great problems. They were the big problems. And yet every time they came to one of these minor problems, one of these trivial problems, they panicked. They lost their nerve. The argument from the greater to the lesser. The next argument that Jesus uses is the argument from the lesser to the greater. I hope I get this right. The argument from the lesser to the greater. And it's the opposite argument. It's another argument from logic, but it's the opposite argument. In other words, if God cares enough to take care about comparatively unimportant things, how much more can we trust him to take care of really important things? This is what Jesus says, isn't it? If God clothes the grass and the flowers, if he feeds the birds, if he cares like that about flowers and grass and birds, how much more valuable you are than they are. You are of more value than many sparrows. And therefore, how much more will he care about you? Now, Jesus clearly enjoyed and admired creation as the work of his Father. And he tells us to do the same, and we really should. I hope you do. We've no excuse, we people who live in Kendall, about not enjoying God's wonderful, our Father's wonderful creation, including the birds. I have exhorted you with regard to this before. The Authorized Version talks about considering the fowls of the air. And it is a biblical command to consider fowls, to engage in fowl consideration. In other words, bird watching or ornithology. And I agree absolutely with John Stott in this respect. He is a bird watcher as well as a preacher. And I'm glad to say that one of my achievements since I've been at Kendall is that I've converted one person to fowl consideration, to ornithology, to bird watching. And that's Simon. He is now a convinced, committed bird watcher. In fact, he actually went and saw a spoonbill at Leighton Moss and told me about it, and I went to confirm it, and it was there. And Simon, who had only been a bird watcher for a week, saw it before me. And we all ought to be bird watchers. Jesus commanded it. He said nothing about train spotting. He said a great deal about bird watching. And last Thursday evening, lovely evening, Thursday evening, I took the evening off. I went at 6 o'clock to Bassenthwaite, got there at 7, sat by the lake until 8, got back for 9, and I spent an hour watching the osprey. The female has flown, and the male was on the nest, and the three young birds that have just learnt to fly were all testing their wings and flying around for me while I sat there being eaten by midges, considering fowls, as the scriptures exhort me to do. So, we ought to enjoy God's creation and we ought to learn from it, says Jesus. And the lesson we ought to learn is look at the beauty of those flowers, and look at the thought that God has put into those flowers, which are so short-lived. They're here today, they're gone tomorrow. Look at the birds. They live it a day at a time. They don't hoard food. You don't find a bird striving to be richer than another bird. They just take what comes. They take what God gives. They're very busy, incidentally, birds. They're very active. They're not idle. Unless it's a cuckoo. I don't know why God created cuckoo. The early bird catches the worm. They build nests. They feed their young. They migrate for thousands of miles. Especially if they're Arctic terns. They migrate literally for thousands of miles. Those ospreys are going to go off to Africa in the next few weeks. And next April, they'll be back again at Bassenthwaite in the same place. So they're very, very busy. And it's a tough life for birds. If you have a bad winter, it decimates the population of small birds, the domestic cat, is cutting short the lives of small birds, but they don't worry. They live a day at a time, and they just sing away and chirp away as if they had not a care in their minds. Jesus says, learn from the grass and the flowers and the birds. If your God clothes them, if he feeds them, if he provides for them, if he puts so much thought into them, how much more thought has he put into you? And will he put into you? That's the argument from the lesser to the greater. The next argument, the fourth argument, and there's only six, the fourth argument is worry is pointless and senseless. Verse 27, who of you by worrying can add a single hour to his life? So worrying is pointless. It achieves absolutely nothing. We won't add a single hour to our lives by worrying. It won't stop things happening to us. Worrying won't stop things happening to us. And far from lengthening our lives, worry is far more likely actually to shorten our lives. So Jesus says, don't do it. It's pointless. Our times are in his hand. Psalm 139. Wonderful psalm. I'll just read this little bit to you. You needn't look it up. Psalm 139. He says, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. So worrying isn't going to make any difference. Worrying is not going to make any difference. So it's senseless to do it. It's pointless to do it, sorry. It's also senseless. It's senseless, verse 34. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Worry is senseless because it doubles today's trouble. Jesus says each day will have enough trouble of its own. Now notice that Jesus tells us to expect trouble. Don't read these passages in a sentimental sort of way. Oh, if I only trust the Lord, I won't have any troubles. That's not what Jesus says in this passage at all. He says every day you can expect trouble. What's going to happen today? Trouble. Jesus said. Enough trouble for today. So every day you should get out of bed and say, what's it going to be today? It's going to be trouble. And it's going to be enough trouble for today. And it's assumed that trouble will come our way on a daily basis. And Jesus says, why double today's trouble? By adding tomorrow's trouble to today. Live a day at a time. In other words, Jesus is saying, get on with today's trouble by the grace that God gives to you and trust him for the grace to deal with the trouble that's going to come tomorrow or whenever. In other words, apply all your energy to today's trouble. Listen to what J. Adams wrote some years ago. He wrote, tomorrow is not for us. Tomorrow is not for us today. It does not belong to us. Tomorrow always belongs to God. Tomorrow is in his hands, and when we try to take hold of it, we try to steal what belongs to him. Today belongs to us. God has not given tomorrow to us today. He has given us only today. He strongly forbids us to become concerned about what might happen. That is entirely in his hands. End of quote. Now, as I understand it, God has given us chemicals like adrenaline, which are actually designed to deal with problems. And worry gets the adrenaline and various other chemicals going in our bodies. But if we're worrying about tomorrow's problems, there's no actual problem there for all that adrenaline to deal with, to take action against. So what does frustrated adrenaline do? Well, it's got no actual problem today to work on, but we've managed to create all this adrenaline to deal with problems that aren't there. So what does the adrenaline do? Well, it takes it out on us. It goes to work on us. It goes to work on our minds. It goes to work on our bodies. It goes to work on our hearts. It goes to work on our stomachs. And we get all kinds of nasty things happening to us, because we're not using the God-given adrenaline for what he gave us it for, which was to deal with real problems. God gives us today's adrenaline for today's problem. And using it for tomorrow's problems, which aren't actually there yet, means that we don't actually deal properly with today's problem. So things get worse, and we're in a vicious circle. Okay, so that's the fourth argument. The fifth argument, Christians, and I think this is the really important argument, actually. Christians have more important things to worry about. Look at verses 31 to 33. 31 to 33. Do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Jesus is talking in this passage about Christians worrying about the things that pagans worry about. What do pagans worry about? They worry about the length of their lives. They worry about the quality of their lives. What they're going to eat, what they're going to drink, what they're going to wear, how long they're going to live. Christians have more important things to worry about, to bother about. Jesus has just said that the heart of the Christian, the treasure of the Christian, is not on earth. It is in heaven. If your treasure is on earth, then you've got a lot to worry about. And the more treasure you've got, the more you've got to worry about. I'm glad I'm not rich. Imagine if you were a rich person. There might even be one or two rich people here, I don't know. But if you were a rich person, how much you'd have to worry about? The more you have, the more you have to worry about. Jesus said, don't lay up treasure on earth where moth and rust corrupt and where thieves break in and steal. You've got a lot to worry about if you've got a lot of treasure on earth. Lay up treasure in heaven, he says, where moths can't do whatever they... Incidentally, that's another thing to worry about. There was a whole article in the Times the day before yesterday on the comeback of the moth. We're going to have to start getting our mothballs out again. It's another thing to worry about. It said, examine your clothing. If there are holes in them, it's too late. So, sorry, I've gone off the track. Yeah, lay up treasure in heaven where moth can't eat. What's there? And where the burglars, the thief, can't steal what's there. And rust can't corrode what's there. It's absolutely safe if it's in heaven. You've got nothing to worry about if it's in heaven. If you've got treasure on earth, you've got loads to worry about. And the more you've got, the more to worry about. If your treasure is in heaven, you've got nothing to worry about. Absolutely nothing to worry about. It's secure. It's safe. Pagans run after these things, says Jesus. People who don't know God run after these things. They pursue these things. They compete for these things. Christians don't. And if you're not running after these things, if you're not pursuing these things, you won't worry about them. You'll only worry about them if you pursue them. If they're important to you. If they're not important to you, you won't worry about them. So seek first God's kingdom and God's righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you, says Jesus. See, it's not enough just to tell people not to worry. That might even make them worry more. You have to give them something bigger and better to worry about or to be concerned about. So Christians have more important things to worry about. And the final argument, prayer. This passage about not worrying comes up after quite a long passage in Matthew 6 about prayer. It's the passage which contains the Lord's Prayer. And in the Lord's Prayer, the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples, he tells us what our greatest concern should be. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And because I won't be able to do your will on earth unless I am on earth, and if I am on earth I need some bread, give us today our daily bread. But only so that I can do your will on earth, that's all. And only bread, not steak, and not bread for next week or next year, but bread for today. Give us today, this literally means, give us today our bread for today. I want to do your will on earth as it is in heaven today. In order to do that, I need some bread today. Obviously, you know that, Lord. Give us today our daily bread. Prayer. And when we move to the Philippians 4 passage, Paul confirms this, of course. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything. Chapter 4 of Philippians, verse 6. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. You know, it really encourages me when I read Paul's letters and I find that even he couldn't actually practice what he preached. Don't be anxious about anything, he said. What does he say in chapter 2, verse 28? He sends Epaphroditus back to the Philippians because he'd been so ill. And they'd heard that he was ill, and they were worried about him, so he decided to send them back so that they could see he'd actually got better. Verse 28, therefore I am all the more eager to send him, so that when you see him again you may be glad, and I may have less anxiety. Come on now, Paul. What are you going to write in chapter 4? Do not be anxious about anything. But you were anxious about Epaphroditus, Paul, remember? And what does it say in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 28? He says, I have the care of all the churches. And it's the same word. I have the anxiety. I have the worry of all the churches. Pull yourself together, Paul. Are you worrying about those churches? You've just said you shouldn't be. Look at what he says in 2 Corinthians chapter 2. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, I'll just read it to you, you needn't turn to it. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 12. When I went to Troas to preach the gospel of Christ and found that the Lord had opened a door for me, I still had no peace of mind because I did not find my brother Titus there. So I said goodbye to them and went on to Macedonia. How human Paul is, isn't he? God has opened a door for him to preach the gospel in Troas. He's preaching the gospel in Troas. He's got no peace of mind. Why? He can't find his brother Titus. So he says, I'm going to have to leave this for a bit. Can't concentrate. Must go and find my brother Titus. So I said goodbye to them. Went on to Macedonia. Come on now, Paul. Come on. No anxiety about anything, Paul. It's good to know that he was just as human as you and I, wasn't he? But you know, it's all right to be anxious about other people. It's all right to be anxious about Epaphroditus. If you weren't anxious about Epaphroditus, you probably wouldn't pray for Epaphroditus, would you? If you weren't anxious about the churches, Paul, that you had planted, you wouldn't pray for them, would you? So there is such a thing as legitimate concern for other people. Yes, we should be anxious about the church. What we shouldn't be anxious about is our own position in the church, our own reputation in the church, our own status in the church. And let's face it, when we're anxious about the church, very often that is actually what we're anxious about, isn't it? It's not that we're anxious about the church, it's that we're anxious about me and what people think of me and my position in the church. And my status in the church. We shouldn't be anxious about that. That's in God's hand. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter at all. Church matters. Your position in the church doesn't matter in the slightest. Okay. So prayer. And can I just say, and then I'm going to finish. Behind this statement, do not be anxious about anything, there is another statement in Philippians. And I think you couldn't have this statement in Philippians 4 without the other statement earlier in Philippians. And the earlier statement is in chapter 1 and verse 21. And it says this, "For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. He's just said, you know, he's in prison, he's chained to a Roman soldier. And he's just said that there are people who are preaching the gospel. They're taking advantage of him being in prison by preaching the gospel, not out of love, but out of rivalry and out of self-interest, because they want to win some of Paul's converts to be their disciples. So they're preaching the gospel in rivalry to the Apostle Paul, who is in prison for a while. Paul says, "Do I care? Not a bit of it. Do I care? Not at all. They're preaching Christ. And my only concern is that Christ is preached. That's the only thing I'm worried about, that Christ is preached. For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." So what's the worst thing that can happen to you? What is the worst thing that you're worrying about? The worst thing that can happen to you is that you might die. Paul says in that passage, "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far." Do we actually, really believe that? "I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far." If that is the worst thing that can happen to you, Paul says it's the best thing that can happen to you. So what are you worried about? That is the secret of Paul's freedom from anxiety. And the result of that and prayer is the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, which might mean the peace given by God, or it could mean the peace enjoyed by God. The sovereign Lord God over this chaotic world, the chaos doesn't touch him in the slightest. If ever there was a being that was at peace, it is God. The peace enjoyed by God. And he, if we follow the precepts that I've given to you this evening, we increasingly, I believe, will come to share, will come to enjoy not just the peace given by God, but the peace enjoyed by God. Amen.